You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. At 16, Kira Bell was prescribed puberty blockers by the National Health Service's gender clinic in the UK. She went on to take testosterone before getting a double mastectomy in keeping with her identity as a trans man. Bell is now 23, has detransitioned, and is suing the Tavistock Gender Identity Development Service, challenging the idea that minors can consent to hormone blockers and other medical routes towards transition. Thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate it. I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So let's start at the beginning. When was it that you started to feel... I mean, you can describe it better than I can, but let's say, when did you start to feel that you were different?
Well, I mean, really, it started from a very young age when I was, you know, around 5 or 6, you know, when I started to kind of diverge from, you know, the girls around me, I suppose, you know, dressing in stereotypical boys' clothes, and, you know, my interests started to change to a more, you know, or develop into a stereotypical male kind of interest, and things like that. And, you know, that alone definitely brought, you know, a lot of feelings of alienation. But I wouldn't say at that stage I necessarily thought anything was, you know, wrong, but I was also very young, so who knows what I was thinking at that time. But it wasn't until I was around 14 that I actually thought, you know, something was seriously wrong, I suppose. So yeah, about 14.
And what was it that you began to feel?
I guess just extreme discomfort with, you know, going through puberty and, you know, just my place in the world. You know, a lot of things I was struggling with, you know, my sexuality as well. And it just led to me feeling really alone. And, you know, because I didn't see anyone else, you know, speak of these sort of feelings, or, you know, no one else seemed to be going through it. You know, I thought, yeah, something was wrong with me. And that led to thinking that something was wrong about my sex. And yeah, shortly after that, I came across transsexualism, or at least looked at it in a, you know, a more critical manner into, you know, how that relates to me. And yeah, things just progress from there.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, do you think that you were having a different experience than, I mean, in retrospect, as opposed to at the time? At the time, you obviously did feel you were having a different experience. But in retrospect, do you think that you were having a different experience than other girls your age, in terms of, you know, what you were experiencing maybe at school or going through puberty, or in terms of your sexuality, your body, things like that, your mental health? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, no, I don't think it was, you know, any different to a lot of the girls, you know, that were around me. But I definitely think, you know, being a lesbian or having, you know, struggling with your sexuality, you know, that's perhaps not as common. And, you know, being a tomboy in its own, that's not, you know, it's not extremely common. So, you know, I think it was that, you know, and not having many tomboy friends or things like that. I honestly don't know, but yeah, I definitely think it was also an environmental kind of thing. If I had more tomboy friends maybe to, you know, speak openly with, maybe things would have been different, but it wasn't like that.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid in like the 90s, being a tomboy was like, you know, that was a pretty common term. I felt like I was a tomboy. All the I don't know, like characters in books or movies, TV shows that I looked up to and aspired to be like would have been called tomboys, like, I don't know, Pippi Longstocking, things like that. And is that still a concept or term that is common nowadays for young women, would you say?
Well, it depends what you mean by nowadays, because I mean things are progressing so fast, especially like within the, you know, quote unquote gender sphere. I don't even know if tomboys exist anymore. You know, they're all kind of considered people struggling with their gender, or you know, their gender identity is different or something. But I mean, when I was growing up, yeah, definitely, like tomboy, being a tomboy wasn't, you know, a shocking thing. It was just, you know, it was talked about in a sense that, oh, you know, she'll grow out of it. You know, I was a tomboy when I was a kid. You just grow out of it. And I suppose I didn't. And so maybe that's also where it came from. It's just the fact that I didn't grow out of it. And, you know, I was expected to conform to, you know, feminine or female stereotypes, which I wasn't comfortable with. So, yeah, it was definitely a mixture of things.
Mm-hmm. So at what point did it occur to you that you might actually be a boy?
Well, yeah, it was when I was 14 and I was looking up about transsexualism and, you know, just reading the criteria online, you know, as I did, and I ticked all of the boxes, and, you know, it made sense. You know, it made sense about all the discomfort that I was feeling and, excuse me, why I didn't want to, you know, conform, I suppose. And yeah, it just seemed like the easy way, I suppose, because, you know, I wouldn't have to change myself, at least, you know, how I act in society, I suppose. It was more, you know, bodily changes, which, you know, at that, you know, with my young mind and stuff, I thought that was the best option.
And I mean, so at the time, were you feeling pressure to act like girly in quotation, or act like a girl? Like, I'm assuming that, I mean, correct me, or you can describe it yourself, of course, but I'm assuming that you were sort of feeling like you weren't drawn to stereotypically girly interests or behaviors and things like that. Were you kind of feeling pressure to go in a feminine direction?
Yeah, definitely. I think I felt that, you know, with specific family members, you know, male family members, I think it was seen as a more odd thing, as opposed to like my mother, who was generally very accepting of myself being a tomboy, at least to a certain age. And I definitely think school plays a big part, because you know, you might be considered a lesbian or something if you don't conform, and then, you know, homophobia, and yeah, again, it's a very complex situation as to why, you know, I might have felt discomfort with, you know, being a tomboy in the society that I, you know, or in the environment that I was in.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting, because for all of the like rah 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 celebration around trans identity in general, but, you know, specifically for kids, for youth, whatever, you know, lesbophobia and homophobia remains. You know, I hear a lot from young women like you, either, you know, detransitioners, young lesbians, etc., that there's, you know, a real concern and fear around coming out as a lesbian, or even just acknowledging that you are a lesbian, more so than there is a fear around coming out or identifying as transgender.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was slightly different for me, because, you know, when I was, you know, looking at transsexualism and stuff, it wasn't to the scale that it is now, and so, you know, it wasn't so much, you know, it hadn't entered schools, the trans stuff, it hadn't entered schools, and, you know, that question, you know, oh, are you, what is your gender identity, those sort of questions aren't really posed or weren't posed to me around that age, fortunately. But yeah, I don't know what's going on.
So you came across transsexualism, transgenderism online, and then what happened?
So like I said, all the criteria kind of, I checked those boxes off and it made sense. And I didn't really talk to anyone about it. I think I told like a close group of friends when I decided to transition. But it was just kind of kept between us, and I hadn't told my parents or anything. So it wasn't like a couple years later, till a couple years later when I moved away, and my father's girlfriend took me to the GP, so my local doctor, to speak of the issues, and the referral process kind of started from there.
And so your father's girlfriend took you to your GP, because you had told them what, that you thought you might be trans or.
She kind of picked up on, my physical expression, and they was more on the more masculine side. And, she kind of posed the question to me whether, I was a lesbian, or, dealing with sexuality issues, or if I felt that, I was having some sort of gender issues, which, I told her was the latter, which I felt that I was dealing with gender issues at the time. And so she took me to the GP, and again, it wasn't really super well known then, so my GP was just kind of hesitant to say much besides referring me on to the local mental health clinic at the time. And then shortly after that, they referred me to the Tavistock Kids Clinic.
So that would have been what, like 7 years ago? Is that right? When, how old were you
So
then?
I'm 23 now, so I had my first appointment at the GIDS when I was 16.
So the GP referred you to the NHS, their gender clinic, is that what it's called?
The Gender Identity Development Service. So my GP referred me to the mental health clinic, which in turn, referred me to the Gender Identity Development Service at the Tavistock.
And what was that process like? What happened at that point?
When I arrived at the Gender Identity Clinic. It was very brief. I had about four sessions before, treatment, medical intervention was spoken about, and I got referred. During that time, it was just very brief, and just they went into like my brief family history, and asked me brief questions on what it was like growing up. Did I like to play with stereotypical boy things or stereotypical girls things? Just very on the surface kind of questions like that. There was no therapy or anything like that to speak of.
And did they diagnose you with gender dysphoria?
I believe so. I think at the time it was still considered gender identity disorder. That was the diagnosis they gave me.
And I mean, how many sessions did you have there? Like how many times did you have more than one appointment where they discussed these issues with you?
So I had about 10 or 11 in total. That was, whilst I was going through the medical treatments. But it was about four sessions before I was actually put on the blockers, which then, spiraled into testosterone, and then eventually surgery through the adult clinic.
So, was it, did you request puberty blockers or was that suggested to you?
That was suggested to me. I mean, at the time, I was very eager to start the medical transition because I thought it would help me, and I thought it'd be life changing, in a positive way. But because of my age wasn't quite at the legal age for them to give me testosterone, or it didn't fit in with their policy in some way. So they just kind of offered the blockers to me as a way to kind of buy time and just to think more on what I wanted to do. But we know now that that's not the case, and they also said it was reversible, which we also know isn't the case. So there was a lot of lying going on, basically.
Did they tell you about any side effects of the, was it Lupron that they gave you?
No, it was called gonopeptyl.
Okay.
So I think it's a different, strand of it or whatever.
Okay. And did they say that there were side effects?
I think they gave kind of a basic overview of the side effects, like hot flushes and maybe a bit of insomnia or night sweats and things like that. But I only remember, those main kind of issues explained. There was nothing about, neurological issues or bone issues, nothing like that really. It wasn't ever, or fertility, that was very, they spoke of that in a very flippant manner. So again, it was all very surface level, I thought.
And what was that experience like of being on puberty blockers? Did you notice anything? Did you notice any side effects? Did you notice or anything happening to your body?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I hated it. I mean, the only reason I dealt with it is because, it was kind of talked about as a stepping stone onto testosterone. So, I was just eager to get on that at the time. But, it was horrible going through the, dealing with the effects of the hormone blockers. I did experience all of those things that I just mentioned. And I think later on I've had to deal with the more long-term side effects, and there are still some I'm sure that I haven't actually found out about, things that are going on internally. So yeah, there was a lot of issues that came along with it.
And at some point, when was it that you started on testosterone?
It would have been a year after I started on the hormone blockers. And then they made me kind of take the hormone blockers for a second year along with the testosterone. So I started testosterone when I was 17, and of course it felt good to have hormones back in my body. Basically, my body was starved of any hormones, so that definitely felt good at the beginning to get started on the testosterone.
Yeah. And what were the effects of the testosterone?
So male secondary sex characteristics. So, my voice started to drop, I started to grow facial and body hair. And those genital changes and, things changing with my mood and sex drive and, all the stereotypical things that came with that. And also I know there are a lot of internal changes, as far as your blood and your heart rate and things like that. Which, I wasn't really noticing at the time. So, yeah, a lot of changes came with that.
And at that point, how long had you been had you, I'm assuming you're using male pronouns at that point.
Yeah, very early, actually. I mean, as soon as I went to the GP about it, I'd already started to, change my name and things, yeah.
And what was the response like? When you started to do that, at school with your friends, things like that.
So I mean, I didn't have to deal with many questions or anything because by that time I'd already kind of moved schools. So, I moved school and just kind of introduced myself as, with my male name and pronouns and all of that. I think there was still a bit of confusion at the start because, I hadn't, the effects of the testosterone hadn't kicked in yet. So I still looked very, feminine, or, just looked like a tomboy at the time. So I think there was a bit of confusion, but overall, like, no one knew me. It was a different area, so I was able to, coast through that way.
And in terms of what was the feeling like of being on testosterone? I mean, I know there's the obvious physical changes, and I wonder, like, psychologically, how did that impact you?
Yeah, so I mean, at the time, I was definitely happy, to be on the testosterone. I had those feelings of, I can finally move on with my life, and I can do this and that, and I won't have this hindering me, and so it was definitely good, until it wasn't, basically, which was, literally, at the point where I started detransitioning. And I think that was down to just, realizing, what I was actually doing, and just, trying to get to a place that was unattainable, basically. And yeah, there was just a lot of feelings behind that.
And at what point was the surgery introduced? Was that something that you were pushing for, or was that something that was, introduced to you as an option?
Yeah, so this would have been through the gender clinic, the adult gender clinic. So, I was referred there just before, I turned 18. So I had my first appointment there at 18, and yeah, it was just kind of considered like, oh, okay, like, you're established now, you're an adult, you're still expressing gender dysphoric feelings, you're happy on the testosterone, so it must only be that you want to, proceed with surgery. So, there wasn't, I guess, even less of a pushback there, because you're considered an adult now, and you're considered to be able to make your own decisions as far as surgery and things like that. So again, they just had a very brief overview of how I was doing, and yeah, I got referred on to that. And I think at the point that I wanted to get that surgery, as I think by that time I was just so sick of wearing my binder, and it was hurting, and an annoyance, and also due to the hormones, I didn't like the appearance of my breasts and things like that. So it was more of a practicality sort of thing, and I was like, yeah, just just do it sort of thing. So yeah, that happened when I was 20 years old.
And so that was a double mastectomy.
That's right, yeah.
And what happened then? I mean, when you had that surgery, how did you feel?
Yeah, surprisingly kind of, mellow about it. I didn't really feel anything. I suppose I was quite numb about the situation. Yeah, I didn't have that ecstatic feeling. It was just like, okay, cool, they're gone, like, I can just get on with my life now. And yeah, I think I'm still processing that now, just, the fact that I had that surgery, and how gruesome it really is. I think a lot of the problem is, when people outside of the trans sphere, are accepting of it, and this and that, they don't realize how gruesome all of these procedures are. So yeah, I mean, it was a bad time, really, now that I can reflect back on it.
And when did you begin to think that you may have made a mistake?
Yeah, so that was pretty much like a couple years, maybe, or maybe like a year and a half after my surgery. And then, yeah, I just started to have serious doubts. And I think it was a combination of everything. It was a combination of seeing what was going on, and seeing it kind of explode into, the current trans culture, and how crazy everything was going politically, and all of those issues, as well as, I guess it pushed me in a way to kind of look critically at it all. And yeah, I just thought about, like I said, what I was like really doing, and if it was really necessary, I suppose, at that point, or if I felt it was necessary. So I just started to break everything down and started to realize, that being male or female isn't a feeling, that it's just pseudoscience. And just realizing that, you can be a woman, and there's many different ways to be a woman. So I think that's what it, fundamentally boiled down to.
Were you introduced to feminism at all?
Yeah, I have been now. But when I started detransitioning, I just saw kind of little parts of it just kind of darted around, and kind of with kind of social media, and just kind of the back and forth between the TRAs and radical feminists and things like that. So yeah, that was definitely a little introduction to that. And I definitely think a lot of the points that I made within radical feminism definitely make sense. And it made sense to me at the time. So yeah, that's definitely a small little kind of part of what helped me along with detransition and being able to accept myself who I am, as a woman. So yeah, that was very important.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm primarily thinking about that, what you said, that idea that, there's lots of different ways to be a woman. It doesn't mean one thing. It doesn't mean you have to have, specific interests or a specific personality or whatever. And that was something, of course, that, feminists really pushed for in the second wave. And so I think I was exposed to those ideas. My mom is a feminist. And so I think, I mean, it's not that it was ever perfect. I mean, I remember struggling with like gender and femininity and, feeling like I was supposed to be a way and I wasn't that way, especially as I got older. When I was a kid, I felt, happy and proud and wanted to be kind of tomboyish. But then, once you start going through puberty and you start becoming a teenager and you start, I guess, wanting to fit in that way a bit more, maybe feeling pressure to fit in a bit more, that was still there. But when I was young, there wasn't that concept of transgender. That didn't really exist. And then, there I at least had access to feminism, so I sort of knew like it was okay to not fit in that way and to sort of push back. I wonder if that was sort of like present for you at all.
Yeah, I mean, not in a big way. It was literally just through the internet that, I just, like I said, I just saw kind of different pockets kind of appearing of, radical feminists or any sort of organizations promoting, women's rights and fighting for women's rights. So yeah, I definitely saw a little bit of that. But I think more than anything, it was just, the TRAs just kind of putting their foot in it a lot of the times. Just a lot of what was being said was just crazy to me. I couldn't believe what was actually going on out there in the world. And it just kind of peaked trans, I suppose, very quickly. And yeah, I just kind of, I suppose I just began to wonder what I was a part of, because regardless of whether I'm involved or not, which I wasn't, I had no trans friends. I was very much like in my own little bubble, away from trans stuff. Once I saw all of that, it definitely made me think twice.
I wonder if there are any kind of specific incidences or, I don't know, mantras. Like, were there specific things that happened where you did think that, oh, these TRAs, trans rights activists, are th like, this isn't right, or, this doesn't make sense to me, or something like that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember any like one particular incident. As I think it was just a mixture of everything, the women's prisons issue, women's sports, all the, yeah, all the mantras about trans women are women and that's that, and the craziness, about trans women talking about giving birth or, having periods and stuff like that. That just sounded absolutely nuts, and it still does, obviously. So yeah, it was just a mixture of all of that, and yeah, it just made me think critically about the whole thing.
And at what point did you decide to stop taking testosterone?
Yeah, so that would have been almost 2 years ago now, coming up to 2 years. And yeah, I just thought, I just want to let my body just kind of do its thing. I was also stressed out about the fact that, I'd have to keep taking this for the rest of my life if I wanted to keep up this appearance. And yeah, just my body just felt really unhealthy. And, I was dealing with, things like vaginal atrophy, which was really getting me down. And, I still have to deal with that now. And, I just, yeah, I was really adamant on just letting my body do its thing, first. And then, secondly, work through all the problems that I've been going through and had, and all the trans feelings, all the gender dysphoric feelings. Yeah, I just, yeah, committed to working through all of that.
And at that point, were you able to find support in terms of trying to accept your female body and the detransition process? I don't know. At that point, had you decided you wanted to detransition?
Yeah, so I mean, I didn't really know what I was doing with it, or of course, because we're all guinea pigs in this. I didn't really know what to expect or anything like that. But I definitely knew that, yeah, I just wanted to let my body do its thing, and yeah, I was pretty committed to staying off of it. And yeah, coming back home in a sense, yeah, just returning to to Kira. Yeah, just I was born that way, and my parents gave me that name, and I was determined to just kind of get back to reality, basically. So yeah, those were the feelings I was having at the time.
And did you access any kind of like counseling or therapy or anything like that?
Oh yeah, no, I didn't have anything like that. Mainly because I can't afford it, and the NHS services aren't really great. They haven't been, in my experience, the mental health help. I've kind of been out, in and out of that my whole life. But I think the most valuable support, or the only support I had at the time, was kind of like peer to peer, kind of like groups online of other detransitioners, and I just kind of speak to them. And yeah, that's how I got through it for, I'd say that first year.
So tell me about the lawsuit. How did that come about?
Yeah, so that came along, I'd say, later that year. Sue Evans, who started the case with Mrs. A, I think she found me through one of the newspaper articles that was put out. I just kind of explained about my experience and detransitioning and stuff like that. And yeah, I just got talking to Sue, and she's been really supportive throughout it all. Truly, she's been so lovely and always been there. So yeah, I think eventually she just kind of posed the question whether I wanted to take over the case, because she thought it would be beneficial all around. And it was important that my voice was heard in this. So yeah, for her own personal reason, she couldn't really take up the case anymore. So I decided to take over. I had no hesitation about it, really, because again, by that point, like I was saying, about seeing all the craziness that was going on and all the injustice that was going on surrounding children and the treatment that they're getting, and the treatment that I had. So yeah, I decided to take on the case, and yeah, it's all kind of spiraled from there.
And what exactly are you charging the NHS with?
So the idea that challenging the idea that minors can consent to life-changing treatment, hormone blockers. There's no way that they can possibly consent. You know, I think a lot of us didn't really have an understanding or hadn't even had a sexual relationship. So, you know, I think that alone, you can't really understand the importance of sexual function and fertility, you know, the two kind of main things that it affects. You know, let alone all the other things, you know, that change your core being for life. And, you know, I think there needs to be more emphasis on how important, you know, your sex is, because it's, you know, it's considered like a insignificant part of yourself by the TRAs, but you know, it's your core being, in my opinion. And it's, you know, really important to how we interact in society and with each other. So yeah, that, you know, I think it's really important that I took this case on and my voice was heard, because, you know, it's not just an abstract thing that's going on. This is affecting hundreds, if not thousands, of girls and young people out there.
And what's the current status of the case?
Yeah, so just waiting for the judgment, which is to be heard next week, on the 1st of December.
I wonder, in Canada, there's a bill, Bill C-6, that's currently kind of working its way through the system. And if it becomes legislation, it will effectively criminalize what's called the watchful waiting model, which essentially, it ensures that the affirmation model is the model that's practiced, and those who don't practice that model, could be either fined or even sent to jail. So obviously, a lot of women's groups are really concerned about this, because in Canada, kids are already being fast-tracked through this process. Minors are able to access puberty blockers and hormones, and even surgery without the permission of their parents, again, while they're underage, 16. And I wonder what you might say. This is being widely supported by almost all of our MPs. The last reading, the vote in favor of passing the bill was like, I don't know, 307-8 or something like that. So I wonder what you might say to the politicians who are pushing through this bill, thinking that they're doing a good thing, right? Like, the bill is called a bill against conversion therapy. So it's on one hand opposed to conversion therapy being imposed on, gay and lesbian youth, but then they've lumped in gender identity as well. So they're conflating a lot of ideas, of course, but our concern is not with the aspect of conversion therapy that tries to turn gay or lesbian kids straight, because of course that's wrong. Our concern is that, again, kids are being fast-tracked through these processes when they really probably don't know what they're getting into, and that have these long-term impacts that are not really being talked about so much.
Yeah, I mean, I think ultimately there's got to be a misunderstanding there from, you know, the people, you know, that aren't trans lobbyists. You know, there's got to be a misunderstanding there, or, you know, they've got to be, or you know, they're evil. So I mean, there is something similar that kind of was pushed over here, but I know it's like amplified times 100 over in Canada. Which is the MOU, the Memorandum of Understanding on Conversion Therapy, which is, you know, just a memorandum, so it's, you know, it's not firmly into the law. But I almost took up a case with that, because yeah, they are conflating sexuality with gender identity, and it can get very confusing for people. I don't know what it's like in Canada at the moment, but you know, I'm sure a lot of people are confused on what's actually going on. You know, they look at it and they just say, "Oh yeah, of course, conversion therapy is an extremely bad thing. You know, let's vote this in. But you know, I think they're gonna regret it sooner or later, because it's gonna end up in, you know, wide scale harm of children. And you know, there's gonna be a lot of similar cases to mine arising in the near future if that bill goes through.
So they trans activists, these like charities and organizations who advocate for the transitioning of kids, of teens, they'll say, as they did to you, that puberty blockers are reversible. They'll say this is just to buy you some time. They'll say, if you go on puberty blockers or if you take hormones, if you change your mind, you can just stop. There's no long-term harms. What were the long-term or permanent impacts for you of taking puberty blockers and then testosterone?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the bad thing is I don't fully know. You know, I can say symptoms that I've had, and you know, the more obvious kind of physical changes. But you know, I've had no testing to say, oh yeah, this has affected this or this has affected that. And there's also no way to say, you know, there's no hard line between what's been affected by the hormones, like the testosterone, versus the hormone blockers. But you know, I can definitely say that it's affecting my day-to-day life, and you know, it is going to affect me for the rest of my life, because you know, I have to live with the permanent changes. And you know, I don't know. I you know, like I said, I think your sex is a very core part of how you interact with society and others within society. And you know, my appearance will be changed, and has been changed for the rest of my life. So I have to deal with that. So yeah, no, it is terrible. I think, you know, they're evil, that those that are promoting the idea that you could be born in the wrong body, and lying, just strictly lying about the nature of these drugs.
And what might you say to girls, to young women who are feeling that maybe they might really be boys and maybe they want to transition because they believe that'll make them feel better, feel more like themselves, feel happier, resolve their struggles with gender or their body, etc.
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely say getting therapy from, you know, someone that's impartial is definitely, you know, key. But I know that's not always possible, nor is, you know, a lot of these young women, are they gonna, you know, be interested in that? Because, you know, once your mind gets set on something as a teenager, you're usually very dedicated to kind of pursue that. Or, you know, you either don't want to admit, or maybe you don't want to admit that you've gone down the wrong path, or are going down the wrong path. So I mean, yeah, I think I've been asked that question a few times before, and I don't have all the answers, but I definitely think it's, you know, it's up to the institutions to make these changes so that there's no possibility that they can, because there is no way they can truly consent to medical intervention. So you know, I can just only hope that they have parents that can see common sense, and yeah, just have good people around them.
And what do you hope the judgment will be?
Oh yeah, I mean, it would mean the world to me if they, you know, if the decision went in our favor. You know, it would mean so much, you know, whether, you know, these young people realize it or not. You know, later on, I think, if it was to go in our favor, they would definitely be very thankful that, you know, these drugs had been, you know, kept away from them, basically. I mean, it's, yeah, you know, I think a lot of these young women and girls that are eager to, you know, start the medical process, they don't realize how, you know, again, it comes down to consent. They can't realize they can't know how it's going to actually affect them in their adult life. So I can only hope that it would go in our favor. But in the case that it doesn't, I'm just happy that I was able to be involved and bring more awareness to it. And yeah, I'll keep fighting.
Can I ask you what this process was like in terms of the court case and the response to you? I mean, have you received a lot of support?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the support has been overwhelming. Yeah, it's been brilliant. I've met lots of people, that are like-minded. And yeah, I haven't received any negativity, at least not, it's not been directly towards me, so I haven't seen it. And so yeah, I think at the end of the day, most people have common sense. And they can see that it's wrong what's going on, and so yeah, it's been great, the support, and yeah, I can only thank them. There's been so many women before me that have been pushing for this for years, and they're very eager to see, yeah, the decision go in our favor as well.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Thank you so much for talking with me today. It was really great, and I think that you're really brave, and I really commend you for what you're doing. And I wish you all the luck in the world in terms of the case. I hope that it goes in your favor.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I'm really appreciative of what you're doing out there in Canada as well. I know it's crazy what's going on. Like I said, it's amplified times 100 over there. So yeah, no, good luck to you and what you're getting involved with as well.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care. Have a good day.
Okay, bye-bye. You just heard an interview with Kira Bell, a 23-year-old detransitioner who is suing the Tavistock and Portman NHS Trust, which operates a number of gender identity clinics in the UK. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. You can find us online at feministcurrent.com, tweet at us at feministcurrent, or send us an email at info@feministcurrent.com. We are hosted by Libsyn, and you can subscribe to the Feminist Current podcast anywhere you like to listen: iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Cast, TuneIn, Spotify, and beyond. You can even give us 5 stars and a review on iTunes. Feminist Current is produced and hosted by myself, Megan Murphy, out of Vancouver, BC. If you enjoyed this podcast, consider making a donation to support our work. Just visit feministcurrent.com and click the donate button.